in the summer of 2023, I wanted to start a housing project because, as most of y'all know, I want to one day run for a local office. And I've been asked many times that if I was in local office, what my number one concern would be. And the answer was simple: housing. So after I brainstormed about how to fix this issue, I ran into so many other issues that I've had to fix before I even got to this problem, so I quit working on it. I had the wonderful opportunity to complete two projects with the city, and after those were complete, I just felt the pull back to this housing project again. So this time I decided to take a different route. I came to the mayor and the judge with this idea, and they actually took me seriously. So in November of last year, we decided to start working on a housing project together. One of the biggest issues affecting our community is the lack of not only housing, but affordable housing. In our community, this issue was elevated greatly by the December 10th, 2021 tornado. After the tornado, approximately 200 homes were destroyed and 150 were affected in a community that was already in a housing crisis. Over the past 14 years, the city of Princeton has torn down approximately 50 houses due to being unsalvageable. These houses were neglected for years and posed a hazard for the safety of the neighborhood. This could have been prevented by properly caring for these structures, by keeping up with necessary maintenances, and around 50 families could have occupied these homes now. We currently have 13 houses on the foreclosure list due to not being maintained or being abandoned. We hope that real estate investors or entrepreneurs will purchase these homes and make them livable for families. One of the biggest factors in this housing crisis is the increase of the interest rate. In 2020, the interest rates were around 2.5% to 2.75%. In a short period, they climbed from 2.5% to doubling at the rate of 6.6%, which greatly increased the cost of homeownership and rent. Workers on average need to annually make $42,000 to afford your average two-bedroom housing unit for rent. The median gross rent for the county went from around $610 to its current monthly rate of $706 in just a year, which has placed a strain on the budgets of all families. In conclusion, we are determined to improve the housing market in our community. We are currently seeking partnerships with organizations to build new affordable houses. We are trying to find new ways to encourage investors to continue to renovate currently unlivable houses. This will be a long-term process. It's a marathon, not a sprint. But we hope it will stabilize the cost of housing. I have learned so much just by doing this project. My guys have taught me all about how to be a responsible homeowner and how to properly maintain a house. They have taught me all about mortgages and interest rates and tax deductions and monthly payments. And let me tell y'all, I never thought about any of that until I started this project. They're like my real world teachers. I have never learned about any of this in school, but I can tell y'all about trade routes. Tell y'all that. I know all about that. So not only am I getting to work on a project that I love with two of my closest friends, but I'm also learning lots about how important it is to be a responsible homeowner.
Sure. And I'll start by saying, and I know no one in this room needs a reminder how remarkable Boo is and how excited we are to work with her. I mean, her passion for this project has been second to none, and it's funny. She said that we took her serious, and it's hard not to take somebody like Boo serious because the amount of time and effort she puts in to anything she does is remarkable, and I cannot wait until she takes my job. I'll give it to her today if she was a little bit older. But no, you know, this is obviously a pressing issue, you know, from the industrial development side, economic development side, just basic humanity side, being able to make sure that people have safe, sanitary housing. And of course, that phrase has really entered into our lexicon after the tornado, the importance of safe, sanitary, affordable housing. You know, one thing that we started when I was mayor, through the good work of our code enforcement officer at that time, which that has continued with Alan, is we started an amnesty program. You know, many communities find partnerships with organizations like Habitat for Humanity or other home building organizations where they are able to accumulate as a city lots due to code enforcement efforts and then be able to provide those cost effectively or at no charge to those organizations so they can build homes in established neighborhoods. So we started an amnesty program which allowed a large number of individuals that for whatever reason, whether or not they had bought it as an investment, they went terribly sour, if they inherited it for whatever reason, if they had a dilapidated home on their hands, that they had the opportunity to first agree for the city to go in and remediate the issue, because obviously we never want to do it under our own name. We like to pass that liability off. So we would tear down the home while it was still in their ownership, with the understanding that once the home was demolished, that if they signed over the property to the city, we would just wipe away whatever debt, whatever lien was against the property, and then they were able to walk away from it. Because one of the biggest issues, and this kind of goes part and parcel, you know, Boo was talking about that this is such a multifaceted issue, but one of the things, and I think I brought this up a few years ago, that most people don't think about being an issue in a community such as ours is, there is such a small percentage of individuals, and I will hang my hat on that, there is a small percentage of individuals that actually have clear title to their property. The amount of individuals that have actually inherited their property through estates is remarkably small. And of course, that leads to multiple issues down the road. Being able to, and I'm sure we got some bankers here, if you don't have clear title to your property, it's hard to build wealth. You can't borrow against it. I mean, being able to take out HELOCs. I mean, being able to maintain your home that you don't actually have ownership of is a bar that many individuals in our community face. And so, you know, trying to be able to find a way to make people understand the value of estate planning. You know, it really comes up a lot in code enforcement, you know, as we were trying to track down owners, even for houses that we didn't necessarily want to tear down. But a lot of times it came up with the amnesty program. You know, we would go and find that it was last owned by a grandmother, a great aunt, somebody that had died 50 years ago. And then we would go through the process. We would essentially do title searches as a city. So we would go through, we would identify the children, we would identify the grandchildren. You know, if one of the children had died, we'd have to go to the grandchildren because they would inherit their property stake. And of course, most people don't realize, but there's automatic inheritance laws in Kentucky. There is a formula. So if you die without a will, your surviving relatives get a certain percentage of that property. And so, of course, you multiply that. I mean, with some of these properties that we were dealing with, I mean, we would get down to 30 heirs at a percentage each, which, of course, at that point, we can't get 30 people to sign off on a document for the amnesty program, no matter if the vast majority of them agree with it. And there is a shortcoming in state law that, as far as I'm aware, it hasn't changed since I was doing code enforcement, but you have to have 100% sign-off. It can't just be a majority stake. You have to have every heir sign off to be able for the city to have clear title, which is really what we need to be able to use it in a productive manner down the road. So being able to find those heirs became impossible, which of course led to the very expensive and cumbersome foreclosure process, which we've been working on for the last few years, and we'll have those, how many is it, 13 that are about to be up?
Yes.
Which of course, you know, that's great. That gives the opportunity for it to change ownership and be in more productive hands. But we also run the risk of some of these homes that need some of the TLC being acquired on the courthouse steps for a steal from some of our, would you call them frequent flyers with our code enforcement department, which sometimes can continue to just add to the problem. So, you know, Boo really hit the nail on the head when there's so many different aspects and so many different ways to look at this. But saying all that, we were able to accumulate, I guess, about 10 or 12 free and clear properties around the city that are now in our ownership, and we would love to find some organization like Habitat or any other nonprofit to be able to come in, have the expertise, and be able to build those safe, sanitary, and affordable homes on these lots. And the other side of that, I'm sorry, I hope I'm not, y'all jump in
oh,
any time.
No, you're good.
Not trying to monopolize, but you know, the other aspect of it, and Amanda can speak to this as well, utility costs. There is an incredible value in being able to build an infill house in an existing neighborhood compared to a new build, simply because the cost of utilities, you know, everybody talks about inflation. Inflation has been terrible across the board. Nowhere more so than the cost of building out our utilities, especially water and sewer infrastructure. It is astronomical. And so when you have a greenfield and you're trying to lay out a new development, even if all the rest of the numbers work out, usually when they see the utility cost for being able to run those new lines is when we lose developer interest. Which, you know, being from a small community like we are, and many small communities are having to face this issue, you know, the vast majority of our infrastructure was built in the post-World War II boom. So many of our small communities are running up on the very, very ends of their depreciation schedules. You know, you see it in Sturgis, you see it in Marion. A lot of these communities are faced with smaller populations than when they originally built this infrastructure, increased costs, and they're at the end of the usable lifespan, which, you know, Sturgis has been in discussions. Their water utility has cost them so much money, I believe, that they've even discussed de-establishing themselves as a city. So I think you'll see that across the board. And, you know, even the city of Princeton, the last time I think I talked to James, we were at 65-70% fully depreciated water and sewer infrastructure in our existing neighborhoods, which of course always leads to the question, where do we put our limited assets into being able to maintain services to our existing communities, or how do we squeeze blood out of that turnip to be able to build to, you know, new build speculative neighborhoods, which we think would do very well, but which is a gamble. So that is why there is so much value, and that's why I appreciate so much Boo's outreach and her attempt to make connections with these organizations and to work with the city for these existing lots, because being able to rebuild our neighborhoods have a tremendous plethora of benefits. Not only does it increase the value and attractiveness of our existing neighborhoods, you know, benefiting our current constituents and citizens, but the water and sewer infrastructure is already there, being able to reduce development costs and hopefully being able to encourage developers to continue to make investments into our community. So that's my I took up too much time.
You're now fine.
You go.
Here,
okay. I'll switch.
Here, yeah.
My part will be short.
That's my soapbox.
Yeah, my part will be short and sweet. I've enjoyed working on this project. I was approached probably first about housing by Ms. George. She gave me a note and passed along on some ideas and what we hope to accomplish. Then, of course, partnering with Isabella and the judge, we look to continue to work on this problem. You know, for the next, it'll be a multi-year project. It will go on for years, and we hope to get it started where the people after us can you know, pick up and take on this project.
Well, she's standing right there,
yes.
People after
yes.
us.
Yes. The person after
us. Yeah, the person after us, whoever she may be.
But what this will do is it will allow us to tackle this project with new housing and reconditioned unlivable housing. So we're going at both ends to try to keep it as affordable as possible. And I'm happy to announce that Isabella has agreed to come on with the city as an intern. So starting the 28th of this month, she will be at City Hall. She will be working. And we look for her to expand on her roles and not only continue on this project, but future projects. So appreciate you. Any questions?
Yeah.
I mean, it's always exciting to hear about some of our beautiful neighborhoods that are not once beautiful and sadly and getting a resurgence. But has there been a discussion or funds or grants available for sidewalks? Because sidewalks are how we connect streets to each other. And, you know, that I think that, what, any discussions on that? I know we've talked about that before. But
we are looking at those grants.
Okay.
I mean, I don't have anything concrete yet, but we are looking at those grants. And it's interesting, in the city, the property owners actually own the sidewalk. So we would fill out those grants, and they would have to sign off and allow us to come through and work on those. And I think Mayor Cherry was successful with that several years ago in doing that. So we would probably try to mirror that along with you know, the housing projects, to because you do see an increase in walking traffic. I mean, and it is, I'd say my first 8 months in office got no calls about streetlights. The last 3 months, I've had probably six, because people are out walking more at night, kids are out playing, and safety issues. I mean, it's big, so we're definitely looking at those.
Interestingly enough, there's a great grant opportunity, the Transportation Alternative Program, TAP, through the federal government. It's an 80-20 matching grant. But unfortunately, with it being federal money, it has some interesting strings attached. When I came into office, because it's a three-year performance, period of performance, we were almost out of time because the State Historic Preservation Office would not sign off on a block wall in front of a historic home that it, in and of itself, was not historic. But because it was adjoining a historic property, they delayed 3 years our reimbursement for that project. It was interesting to say the least.
And a couple of our tornado damaged neighborhoods that the judge started when he was mayor, the FEMA appeals process, we've been denied once, and I'm working with them that we can go ahead and apply for safe funds. But if that's not approved, we will have to wait to be denied a second time for Country Club, Meadowbrook, Deerfield to replace that damaged blacktop from the work with that was because of the tornado and during the tornado. So it's just it's such a delay sometimes in the grants. You got to jump through the hoops and the processes. But so, we continue on.
Yeah, talking about utility costs, I always like your number. What was it to build that new water line in the Edible Industrial Park?
Just to run a water line, I think it was a couple hundred feet. It's going to cost us $370,000. To run, it's a straight line. It's flat. It's just, we have all the right of way. We have the property. It's just to run the water line from where it is at in 62, right by BGB Trucking. About 600 feet, maybe? I mean, it's not even a mile. It's just a straight line. It's over $300,000.
The judge was working on some duplexes between Katy Street and Legion Drive, and because of the lack of infrastructure there, sewer and water, it was three or four sets of duplexes, they weren't feasible because of the cost. So now there's storage buildings there, but the cost didn't weigh out. It didn't make sense.
Mayor, can you comment on the 8 houses that we discussed last night?
Yes, it's on 293 North. As you go out of town, you'll see a fenced off area on the right, and there's lots there. And a gentleman by the name of Scott Sanders from Katy's is working on those. He's going to start on houses, 3-bedroom, 2-bath houses with garage.
How far?
It's that big field right before you get to the subdivision, Oak Street, and
right
all that.
Right before Mohawk Drive.
It's still in the city. It's right there.
So we're excited about those. And I wish I had Jenny here. She gave a wonderful report last night at the council meeting on all the things that planning and zoning she has going. So it's an impressive list.
And unfortunately, you know, we don't come today with any silver bullet because this is something so many counties and communities are facing, but I mean, this is obviously a very accomplished group, and we're always open to new ideas or new approaches that we may not be thinking of or that we haven't taken in the past. You know, kind of going off of inflation, I do know one thing we looked into was CDBG. They have a scattered site housing program, which Gail Cherry, when she was mayor, was successfully undertook. And we had reached out to some of our fellow communities to see how they were progressing with their applications. And many of them had actually returned their grant money because cost had risen so much, it became unfeasible for the amount of houses they were actually going to be able to build because those are forgivable loans. So you have to maintain the homes for so long, and there has to be some input from the actual homeowners. And I think they got like $1 million, and they were going to build 8 to 10 homes, and with the prices, they were down to 4. And so it just wasn't. It no longer made economic sense for them to continue with it.
And sadly, construction costs. I mean, my husband is in that business, and mainly in the Nashville area and Clarksville area. And prices are not going up, but they're not going to go down either.
Yes.
And I mean, you know, they're stable. So, you know, wood is stable right now. Insulation, but you know, there's only like 3 or 4 companies in the entire country that make insulation. So they can
set whatever they can charge whatever they want.
Yeah.
Unfortunately.
Well, I was just going to say to Dakota's point about how after the war we, you know, a lot of infrastructure was built after the war, but so was also a lot of housing.
Yeah.
And so I shared this example actually with Jimmy not long ago, when she was talking about housing, and I said, and it actually was built around that parcel where they're talking about the houses on 293.
Yeah.
And I said, well, you know, the difference in today's society and the society of when that, what is the name of that development? I always call it A.Z. Farley's edition, but that's really not.
Oh, that subdivision, is it? Homestead High? No, Homestead's there by.
Anyway,
that has a name.
She didn't know this, and I don't know if you all know it or not, but when A.Z. Farley built that subdivision. Of course, there was no city sewer. Well, he built his own sewer treatment plant for it. It had its own sewer.
Oh, it does.
Yeah. It's been decommissioned.
And tied into the system. Yeah.
But, I mean, that's the difference in how those kind of, how they thought back when building was happening and how people think today. You know, back then, not having sewer, well, we don't have sewer, okay, well, we'll just build our own. You know? I mean, and today, we're trained that, oh, well, the government.
We solve all the problems.
The government solves all these kind of problems.
Yeah, actually, there's a private sewer line rehabilitation project underway around Southside. There's actually still some of those homes that are on their own private sewer line. And I think there's some grant funds that the water department are pursuing. Actually, there's my board member right there.
It's over around the Prairie area.
Yeah.
The Water Commission is working now, I think, to get that settled. They had their own sewer system over there. And then when people started buying houses over there, and some moved out, and some other people bought them, that's where the problem started. So actually, that's one of the many things that your Princeton Water and Wastewater Commission's working on now. Water Commission's got a bunch of projects going on. And you might see them doing one today and another one tomorrow. And with that said, please pray for James. He has COVID. I talked to him this morning.
The cost of those projects, that's a private line, I think, that services, is it six or eight houses over there?
It's about eight.
Yeah, that runs to Katy Street. So it's a big project.
And you know,
all the homeowners have signed.
Yeah.
And you know, really, now that we've got to the point of having to, Franklin Street for some reason always comes to mind because the homes are still there, very attractive. I know it used to be a really happening street, and we've tore down a tremendous amount of the houses on that street. But let's just, you know, play it through hypothetical. You know, let's say we're replacing that water line. Well, when it was originally put in after World War II, I mean, think about the number of houses that it was serving as far as its value per capita. And think about what it would be compared to today with cost, even inflation adjusted, tremendously higher than they would have been back in the 1950s and 60s. And so, you know, you're providing these resources for a diminished number of people. So the economies of scale were never there to begin with, but they are definitely underwater, which is why if we can get that infill, you know, it justifies a lot of these in-city projects tremendously so. But yeah, it's not, there's no unfortunate easy solutions. No. Yeah, that's not, that's why we've got her as an intern, so. Why they put her as an intern.
And then you have those areas where the water flows downhill, and they...
Yeah, physics nice ruins place, it for us every time.
It's that's crazy. I mean, they're nice places, and they... water's in their yards, and it's take. I mean, at some point, you know what's going to happen. The structure's going to start shifting and changing, you know. So, I don't know what the solution is.
And pump stations for sewer lines or gravity feds are bad enough, but a pump station is not fun.
You know, without saying
too many commas and zeros.
Without rewriting how water flows, I don't know what else you can do, you know.
Country Club Hills is another neighborhood that wasn't built. You know, the Country Club Hills wasn't built on the city sewer.
Yeah.
Every property had their own septic system, probably until in late 80s. I'd say mid to 80s was when they put the sewer, the new sewer.
Then connected it there across those fields. I'd say that would make sense.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're very happy with where we are, especially from an economic development standpoint. I'm not just saying that because Amanda's here, but we're very proud. They just announced that Caldwell County has the second lowest unemployment rate in the state at 3%, which is something we definitely like to tout. Our industries are doing absolutely fantastic. But, of course, so many of them would like to expand, and we would love to see them expand and stand ready to help them do so. But being able to add additional worker housing so that people can relocate here, we don't have the unused capacity of workers to be able to justify them expanding any other lines. So it's definitely a chicken and the egg situation.
Well, speaking of housing, Abby, are you all following what's going on in Frankfort with some new statewide laws regarding renters and landlords?
Oh, some of the ordinances that they're trying to get rid of. I knew that was something that I think that's recurrent. They always try to kick those out. I think some of the bigger cities, Louisville and all that, try to add extra ordinances in place. I don't like anything. When Frankfurt says that they're going to make one size fits all, it's usually when it, well, a sewer discussion is very apt when Frankfurt wants to pass new laws and regulations on us. It all runs downhill.
Well, I have a question about the actual housing program. Can you all talk about, like, are we not able to work with Habitat? Like, is what, like, can we bring something like that in to help with housing? I know that's something that y'all tossed around, but, like, what is the roadblock?
I don't know why Habitat left in the first place, but Boo has done a fantastic job making those connections, and I think that there's interest from Habitat. I think it's just them being able to take on the extra capacity as they continue to cycle through some of their tornado houses. Wouldn't you agree that seems to be one of their biggest concerns?
They've accepted, I think, Webster County, Christian County, and several other counties, and so we've opened up dialogue. We're just waiting.
You know, of course, I'm from Madisonville, and I remember an area, Noel Avenue, I don't know if anybody knows where Noel Avenue is, but it just used to be kind of a field, and it is a subdivision now, and there are two apartment complexes there. It's clean, and that's been over probably 20 or 25 years, so it's a long, long term, like you said, but that's made such a difference in Madisonville, you know, and it's close to a school district. It just looks, it's disappointing that we have such a need here, and we can't get that. Are you all seeing an increase in number of people leaving because of the housing situation, or because they can't afford their rent? Are y'all seeing a change in that?
I mean, I don't think we have any specific statistics, but I know a lot of people, like, you know, when they graduate high school, not having that choice to be able to stay around.
Yeah.
You know, the house I ended up buying was one that was actually on the teardown list, so it was about to be a code enforcement case one way or the other. But I mean, trying to find places to relocate back. I know a lot of the people I graduated with, you know, there's just such that massive gap in the market. Either you have the house that essentially is a teardown already that you just need to tear down and replace, or there's such a tight market, prices are so elevated, you know, that sweet spot in the middle is just absent.
What did you say the other day about the house prices?
Huh? We reached out to Rob.
I've said a lot of things.
I got
you.
We reached out to Riles and we asked about house prices, and under the $200,000 range in Princeton and Caldwell County, there were 7 houses. 4 of them were already under contract, so there was 3 houses. Basically, they had under $200,000 that was available. So, you know, and a total of maybe, you know, 13 houses on the market total. So, I mean, it's just supply.
And, like, I know you're not up on the spending here, but, like, that's affecting industry.
It is. Yeah, but basically, because the housing market is so tight and that there's not just single-family homes that are easily accessible for most people to come into, it does, like Coda was saying, it hurts the number of workers that can be attracted to come into the community or that stay here, or the number of people that commute into Princeton to work if they can find a house and a job closer, you know, to where they're driving through, they'll go there instead. Because the unemployment rate is really great, but I know all of our industries could hire and could fill. Most of them will say that they're the most fully staffed they've been, but there's still some openings. So it is a chicken and an egg thing. Do you have a big industrial announcement and then housing comes, or can you convince developers that we need to build housing and then that will attract people?
We've had 2 police positions and 2 public works positions that have been vacant for over a year. I mean, you can't find people that want to work.
And it's been great from a pay standpoint as well. Our occupational tax, I'm sure it has for the city as well, has far exceeded even the rosiest expectations. Our industries are knocking it out of the park. Especially, you know, some of the raises. I think Treehouse, I think, is starting around $20 an hour now, and you just see that trickle down to Hydra Gear, Porter Road, the rest of them. I mean, a tight labor market definitely benefits the workers, but it also is an artificial cap on what we're allowed to, able to do moving forward.
But those workers making more money wanting pre-approvals to buy themselves homes now, and there's no
and there's just no choices.
I mean, I have to stack of pre-approvals. I can't tell you how high.
Yeah.
And there's no homes.
For yeah.
Judge had the 20-plus houses on Sand Lake Road that was set to go, and when the interest rate went up, they had to put the project on hold because they just couldn't make the numbers work. It was originally a rental. Then they went to for sale. Now the numbers just don't work. So it's, you know, the land's still just sitting there. But yeah. I mean, it's
part of that is there's a huge sewer cost. There's not, you know, if you look at the city water and sewer mapping and where parts just dead end and don't interconnect, that you would think that there's parts of the city that have adequate water sewer service, and it's just hasn't been built out yet. So then trying to balance out who pays for the cost of that to extend the lines is also part of the conversation.
I think one of the dangerous things we've done as a society is overlook our legacy utilities for the new utilities. Don't get me wrong, I love internet. I want everybody to have internet. Fiber optic is the future. But water and sewer and electric and gas, I mean, we have to make sure that they are still in supply and available moving forward.
And we're lucky to have a board like Ms. George, or board members like Ms. George that sit on that board that keep us going.
We do have really good relationships with the utilities, you know, working with both the water sewer department and the plant board. I mean,
I was about to say, I have a good relationship with the plant board.
Got a bit of an ear.
Yeah.
Thank goodness, HGTV has been extremely beneficial for, you know, that brings little communities, and their focus is not new, but rebuilding.
Yes.
So I'm curious, you know, and maybe, Boo, in your research, I'm curious what all of these little communities are doing that now are on HGTV, and their communities have grown leaps and bounds because that's what they're focusing on. They're focusing on Franklin Street, north, south.
Yeah.
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 Right there.
I've been to Waco many times. I did not want to go to Waco before the Dayton, started developing. Okay.
It was interesting talking to Habitat and some of those other conversations, because we asked them about, would you focus on trying to renovate some of the existing houses? And their answer was no, because of liability. If we tear down a porch, what happens when we tie into rotted roof? What, not roof, I don't know. See, I know very little. She said that I taught her stuff. New homeowner, I've learned what all that stuff is. Every time there's a sound or a creak, I tune it out.
Yeah.
So.
He knows more than I do.
Don't tune it out too long.
Rafters.
Will they buy a lot on Franklin Street?
Yeah.
And then tie into the existing utilities?
Yeah, they seem very interested in the existing lots.
That's what we're hopeful for.
Okay. And how much influence can a city encourage Habitat to do that? That, you know, we welcome you, however.
Well, and there's costs associated with that. What they like you to do is start raising funds. A house will cost between $150 and $160 completed. So they want you to raise as much as that as you can, and then, you know, it kind of goes over to the next house, and it kind of gets the ball rolling. So that's probably our next step if we are granted admittance into their into the Pennyrail Habitat.
I think the other thing too, that in a smaller town, the piece that's kind of missing here, because kind of like Stephanie, having worked in Madisonville for as long as I did and have, I've watched Madisonville. I mean, I remember when I first went to Madisonville, Habitat there was just a very small little thing. But one thing Madisonville has and Hopkinsville has that a Princeton doesn't have is they have an excellent network of home builders.
Yeah.
And I mean, we just don't have, I mean, if you don't have, I mean, and over there, their contractors are bought into it. So, you know, they may have, they have contractors that they know are going to frame the house, they're going to plumb the house, they're going to put the HVAC in, and they've already got that all, I mean, they just they just do it. I mean, they know when it's time to do it, they do it, and they all work together. The builders over there, they have one of the best home builders associations probably in the state, in Madisonville, Hopkins County. And so, you know, that's one big piece that is missing in a town our size for a habitat organization, because, you know, people think, oh, it's all these volunteers who come in and do all. Well, there is a lot of volunteers that paint and do things that volunteers can do, but when it comes to the actual...
Yeah, they say that even, yeah, the social media, their volunteers are good for the plant the flowers out front. I'm making sure that beam is straight.
You know,
it's all abstract.
Making sure that the water's hooked up properly, the sewers run right, and the
HVAC.
You know, all the people who do that are licensed. You know,
there's a shortage of all of those skills.
There used to be. It's so interesting to look back, especially for a city like Prince. You know, you can't really compare it to Edible and Catawba because they rebuilt their town. But one as old as ours, seeing how home building has changed over the years, what was the driving force? You know, one thing you notice a lot of are two identical houses side by side. And one thing that I learned through some of my research is that a lot of times the owner, you buy a lot, a big lot, and the owner would build one house, and then they would build the second house and rent out the second house to pay for the first house. So that's why they were built, and they build them in pairs all across the community, and it would actually be homeowners doing it as an investment to build the second house to pay for the first. And that's where a lot of these big lots were subdivided out. Like my house was subdivided to two smaller houses that were parceled off years later. They aren't all identical, but I always wondered why houses looked similar, and apparently that's one of the biggest reasons, is that they take the exact same floor plan, and while the homeowner's building it, they just go ahead and build two, and then use the income from the second one to pay off the investment in both of them.
And of course, that's still done all over the country.
Yeah.
You just change the facade, but it's the same floor plan, and that's...
That's what housing developments are.
Yeah, exactly. Any more questions?
And one thing that, sorry, where is that? Sorry.
Go ahead.
I don't think we're all as familiar with regular habitat work as much as we are with their emergency work, because I think we all were introduced to that process through the tornado. That is, they're two different processes, which is what Heath said. So, I don't know how they felt about it, but I was honestly really shocked whenever he told us that we needed to have $150,000 to get one habitat house here. One. I thought that was a lot of money. But like you said, they pay for all of their work, like their utilities, the builders, the drywalling, the floors, and then their volunteer work is kind of like Coda said, the flowers and the grass seeds.
I'll like, screw on the number on the front of the house.
Yeah, I'll hang the wreath.
I think you're right. I do think it was confusing because you and I had talked about mm-hmm. that, because I was like, it's not making sense. You know, we saw them come in and all these Mennonite groups, and but the disaster services part is very different from
they're two different processes.
From building up communities, and we don't have any, we don't have a lot of experience with the deal outside that disaster. So I think you're right about that.
And outside the habitat conversation, when you look at Madisonville, Hopkins County, I'm just using that as an example, but because I'm familiar with it, but also having that core of home builders, and so when they're not building a habitat house, they're over there, their home builders are doing one of three things. They're either helping with a habitat house, they're building a custom home for somebody, or they bought one of these lots from the city, and they're building a spec house on it that they know they're gonna, that they know's in the price range of what they've gone to Kelly at the bank, and they've asked Kelly, how much money can you loan most of the people who are coming in here? And she says, well, we loan them this much. Well, they go on that lot and they build a house that they know for sure. Now, when that person goes to Kelly and says, we need a loan for this house that Mr. Caudill just built, well, guess what? Mr. Caudill's going to sell the house because he already knows how much they're going to get it for, you know. It's
more of an ecosystem.
It grows off of itself. And it's, once it gets going, it, you know, but like I said, a big core of it is just those, the builders, the contractors.
Well, and you know, really, habitat, it's difficult in the first few years, but it's a self-fulfilling, maintaining model because, of course, they pay mortgage payments. It's not a free house, a Habitat house, or houses of that nature.
I think a lot of people, don't.
Yeah, they don't realize. They think it's just to give them the keys. So, you know, you raise $150,000, and then, of course, you have an income-producing asset stream that you can borrow against to build your next. So once you get a staggered, you know, you have a 5, 10, 15, 20 years left on this whatever year mortgage, and you have multiple houses, you have the income and back end that you can then reinvest into new houses. It's a difficult start, I think. I mean, the way that their model works.
You still have to raise $150,000 every time you
want to. Yeah, so before you leave, Boo's going to be there with the, where's the hat?
Oh, my God.
So, Boo, in your research, this Habitat, you've learned a lot. So do they have, let's just say, a checklist of things that a community has to provide before you...
I think it's more community specific. I think the lots, I think they were very interested in the lots, that there was already lots that they could be built on. And I think really it's more about using their umbrella to be able to start raising funds once we get to that. But getting a group together, you've done a great job reaching out to a group. She's got all the groundwork. Surprise, surprise.
And it's too bad they're not here because the Burrises originally, back in the day, when we did have a little bit of, where they tried to do a little bit of Habitat in Princeton, they were very involved. I mean, they were kind of the spearheaders of it.
Yeah, I don't know what happened to Habitat back in the... There were still a few lots floating around.
Exactly, because they were the ones who... They were one of the main ones in trying to get...
How long ago was that?
It's been years.
I think it was like late 90s, early 2000s is when it...
Yeah, it was right when Habitat kind of first started coming to this area, you know. Yeah, it's probably been at least 20 years since
And some of them that you pay, you know, that's kind of what happened, but they weren't paying their mortgage payments.
Yeah.
Okay.
And, you know, I think it's also a good... Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
So is Habitat the most viable option to bring in for help with housing?
Habitat was the most, I think we agreed that that was the most
established in the area.
The best place to start.
Okay.
You know, we talked about some other organizations that we didn't exactly think were the best fit for our community. Yeah. So Habitat was just...
Well, because Steve said that he used to work with the Fuller Center. There are some other organizations that I know what he's talking about that we ran into in disaster services that were very, you know, we only work with this demographic of people, this ethnicity, this sexual orientation, and we had things like that. And Habitat doesn't do that, right?
No, they seem
Habitat
pretty...
is just about housing, period, and helping homeownership.
I think they're really, the only restriction they have is that the homeowner has to be able to contribute. They have to be able to pay back the mortgage.
Yeah.
It's about that only. So it's not really an income threshold. They just have to be active contributors to their own home. Was something that they seem really adamant
about.
But no,
I didn't feel like they had any weird...
Yeah, okay.
No. If we find somebody else, we'll let somebody else take us to the dance. It doesn't have to be Habitat.
Yeah,
I mean, we're not picky.
We need houses.
There were
other
options, you know, because you hear Habitat more than you hear anything else. I didn't know if there were other groups out there.
Habitat fit our... I don't know. I don't know what I'm trying to say. But it fit our...
Well, and it's just well known. It's just kind of a good place to start.
Since the tornado, we were familiar with Habitat because they were doing a lot of work in Dawson.
Before the tornado?
Well, after the tornado, they were...
I thought you said before.
I probably did.
Okay.
See, thank you for keeping me straight.
But Ms. Laura, back to you asked me if there were things that our community could do. He didn't say anything necessarily, but I think that there is just a little bit of common sense behind what a community needs to do. So one thing that I think that we should come back eventually and talk to Rotary about is we need to do a fundraiser. And I have never mentioned this to them. They might kill me in a second, but I'm going to say I think we would love to partner with Rotary and do some kind of fundraiser or something.
Oh, yeah. I thought you were going to say the city and county. No, say the Rotary. That's dodge that bullet.
No,
we'll take Rotary monies every day.
No, I tried to get a grant out of him. He said no.
I checked my couch cushions. I haven't found anything yet.
We're going to need a lot of partners.
Yeah.
So like corporate donors, like our grants, like our all of that.
All of the above.
One thing that Coda had talked about, I'm not going to, like, he said this, not me. It was his idea. But he said that we need to do some community fundraisers so we can be more transparent and the community can know what's going on with it. And they can feel like they're more involved, which is a really good idea whenever you're trying to bring a new organization into your community, to go through your community rather than writing a bunch of grants. You know, we're more open. We can educate them about the organization. So I think just the community talking positively about Habitat's expansion into our community would be a really good start for community support. I think that'd be really great. But
Well, we would, if able to get here, then yes, we would want them to have such a overwhelmingly positive experience.
Yes.
Yeah.
They would want to do it repetitively.
Well, and that's what we want with the gentleman that's building the homes out on 293. Mm-hmm. He's also brought up after that, he's talking eightplexes that he's building in Hopkinsville and Treat County. I think those were the two communities. So we're wanting to make his experience good here, and we want to continue. We want to partner with people that are moving forward.
And I think it's good, you know, the comp plan is about to be up for renewal, and, you know, making sure that regulations, governmental regulations, are keeping up with the time, that we're not married to, you know, outdated notions about needing 15,000 square foot lot, and you have to be 30, you know, 100 foot away from your closest neighbors. You know, a lot of our older neighborhoods, they're housed right after one after another. I mean, as far as being economical, but you know, it got into that whole mindset back in, I guess, the 70s and 80s about having these huge lots and space, and that is, with our current situation, that is not something that's going to be sustainable. Being able to maintain that where it needs to be maintained, but looking at new opportunities for high density, even in our small communities, like with the eightplexes, mm-hmm. and making sure that there's absolutely no barriers to a developer wanting to build here. You know, something simple we did was remove building permit fees. They were only $300 for a new house, but I promise you, we weren't getting many $300 checks. So it was just a small gesture we could do just to show that we don't want to cost you any extra money. We know that there are obstacles to relocating here, and we want to be as welcoming as possible.
Yes.